Without the ones like you, who work tirelessly to keep things running, everything would suddenly stop. Hospitals, factories, schools, and power plants, they all depend on you. No matter the weather, emergency, or time of day, you're the ones who get it done. At Grainger, we're here for you, with professional-grade industrial supplies. Count on real-time product availability and fast delivery. Call, clickgrainger.com or just stop by. Grainger, for the ones who get it done.
Ale, you said 2 to 3 minutes late.
I know, I completely lied about it.
I hate you, dude, just so you know that, okay?
Are we live right now or no?
We are live right now.
Oh, I was going to say something ignorant. Okay, good, good.
how close to ignorant was it?
Pretty ratchet.
It was pretty ratchet. Yeah. I just need you to know, I just had a 20-minute monologue, okay? Yeah. Waiting on you because you told me 2, maybe 3 to 4 minutes late. That was a 20-minute dialogue. I've never done that a day in my life, okay? You this owe me.
This is unlike me, for sure.
This is unlike you. Also, somebody also fines you $10,000 for being late.
100%. Rubles.
And rubles?
In rubles.
Yeah. What is wrong with you, man? I gave them a preference, man, on how we're going to do this show. We're probably going to laugh. We're probably going to talk some football.
The laughers.
Exactly. You remember when Coach T had to tell us we couldn't be around each other in the offseason?
Yeah.
Just because we laugh so much.
So much, bro. Laughs kept us alive.
How did we get to that point, if I can ask you? Because you'll think about it different than I did. The laughers, the goons. Like, how are we goons when we were laughing so much?
I mean, I have a self-serving theory that is...
Can you do me a favor? Can you turn your phone the other way?
The other way like this?
No. Yeah, there we go.
Okay. So my theory is that Coach Munchak used to put little notes in other plays, in the little cubicles that we have to go through all the time.
Yeah.
And he would always attack me. And then it was so funny that it was always constantly laughing at me all the time because I would take it. And because you said that I liked it. So that's how we became the laughers.
As I just burst out laughing again. My brother Ron, you remember him, man? He's like, now that's an entrance right there, man. He's looking too, man. Bro.
Appreciate it, man.
Yeah. You're right. Was I the instigator then?
Yeah, you were an instigator. I mean, obviously, Pouncey was out of control. Gil was the loudest laugh. And then when Finney came in, he relieved the duties of being the abused. And so then we split the abuse between Finney and I.
Finney, no doubt. And I have this Christmas picture and video that shows up when Gil bought you that big bag of gifts. I don't know why that video keeps showing up in my memories.
That is the funniest video I think that defines the entire our entire tenure together. That those Christmas that we would have, where I knew for a fact that I was getting the same gift every single year.
We can't say that on air, but either way, Al, I appreciate you coming in, man, and doing this show. I told them also, why did you try to charge me $50,000 for this interview?
No, because I remember you used to define your friends, and you used to say, you're a 50, you're my guy. And I said, what is a guy? What is the difference between a guy and a guy? And you say, you're my 50, I'll loan you 50K. You know, I'm giving you up to 50K and there's no questions asked. And that was a guy. I don't know what guy was. And then I said, I'm your guy, 50K plus.
You know yeah, I mean? Okay. Yeah, that's very true. We talked a lot of crap, okay? That's what I'm going to say too. But you are my guy though, man. I appreciate you coming on. If you did need it, which I know you don't, you got it, okay?
Nice. Appreciate it. Thank you.
I do. Let's get into it, man, if you want to, Al. What are you doing these days? Let's start there.
So right now I got into farming. I moved to Miami, Florida. We used to have those secret handshakes when we were playing. And we had this ideal that we were all going to live in Jupiter. And then, obviously you started, showing your loyalties towards Tennessee. But we all thought that we were going to move to South Florida. And so I moved down here. I actually went to the University of Miami for a day. I went to class for a day, and then I quit that same day. The first time I ever quit anything in my life. And then I was like, oh, man, what am I going to do? What am I going to do? And then I started looking, started searching, talking to a lot of neighbors. And maybe because of my Spanish background and the Spanish world comes from a more agricultural background. It's not as developed as the industrial Northern European countries. So I grew up in a farm when I was a kid. And then the fact that I saw an article many years ago of a lot of NFL players and coaches who bought farms back in the day in Napa when it was dirt cheap. And then obviously years later, it became an incredible investment. So based on the geography here in South Florida, based on the culture and based on my personal experience growing up in farms and being extremely interested in tropical fruits, then, you know, I started farming probably about a year ago. And so It's been an incredible journey. Yeah.
No doubt, man. Let's go back a little bit too, man, if you want to. Your background, you say your Spanish background, Al. Yeah. You were born in Mississippi, right?
Oh, yeah, that's right. I forgot. I'm from Mississippi.
My bad.
Yeah. I was born in Mississippi. My father was learning how to fly Harriers and F-18s. They're both McDonnell Douglas made jet crafts. And part of the course, it started in San Antonio, where they taught my dad how to speak a little bit of English. And then you move to Meridian, Mississippi, where you learn how to fly a basic plane. And then you finish your course in Pensacola, where you do a jet training. So I was almost a Florida boy, but I became, you know, a member of the Dirty South. And so I guess I'm from Mississippi. I've never been to Mississippi other than when I was born. But yeah, that's where I'm from.
Really? I didn't realize that. And of course, we've gone through it personally, but to just preface this crowd that's watching us out. And from there, you lived overseas in different countries too. Your dad, like you said, is in the service too. So you guys moved and traveled a lot.
What
other countries were you in your upbringing?
So I was born in Mississippi. Then I went to Pensacola. Then I went to Rota Naval Station, where I spend most of my life. I guess I claim it as my hometown in Rota. 2 miles away from Africa. So, you know, I woke up in the morning and I saw Africa every single day of my life. It's funny when I tell people because they always go, oh, you know, but it's true. I mean, it's Europe and where I'm from is extremely close. And then I went up to northern Spain for 3 years in Zaragoza. Then I went to Newport, Rhode Island for 6 months. I was in the World Trade Center a month before they came down.
Really?
Yeah. And then when I went back to Rota, then I started noticing how the United States shifted into a war sort of mindset. And then I went to the Canary Islands for a year. And then finally I went to high school in Belgium. And then from Belgium, I went to an American high school and I played all the, you know, my high school experience was the most incredible experience, I think, that any kid could ever had.
Why is that? In Germany?
No, it was, Belgium, which is
Belgium,
a very small country, very close to Germany. But the United States after World War II had almost over 500,000 U.S. citizens, I mean, U.S. soldiers and their families stationed on West Germany. And obviously because of the Cold War and the wall, there was a lot of tension, the Cold War. So the United States amassed a lot of troops on West Germany. West Germany developed incredibly well. And when it finally came down in the 90s, the United States left their troops in their strategic assets or you know, as part of our foreign policy. And so when I went to high school, I was with a bunch of NATO kids. So all the kids in my class were from all the different countries, but Americans were the majority.
Yeah.
So I went to an American high school and I had that experience of going to homecoming, listen to Usher, you know, you know, all the cultural things that were happening in the 2000s in the United States, I was exposed to them. And then one of my best friends said, the first kid that I met at school, he said, man, we barely got enough kids to form a football team. Why don't you join the football team? And I was playing rugby, you know, in Europe. And so I always looked down on American football because I thought that it was too soft.
From rugby?
I thought it was too soft, and I thought that the ego of the football player was very individualistic. Whereas
now, look at you.
Right now, yeah. Screw rugby. Rugby's the worst. You know what I mean? Give me touchdown celebrations all day in controversial post-game press conferences. But I started playing football, and then to play football, we would get on a bus on Friday, and we would travel around all the bases around Europe, and then we would play all the other bases with all the other the sons of the service members that were stationed all throughout Germany. So it was incredible. It was amazing that I got to travel and I got to see Europe. I'd never seen Europe until that time, but I did it through the American lens of the U.S. military. And then once I met my teachers, I played a little bit of football. They started putting this idea in my head that I didn't have to have good grades. I didn't have to do anything. I just had to be big and tall, and then they would pay for my education. I did not know how that both of them correlated with each other. I did not know how being really big and strong will help you in your education. But I through that, you know, I guess I started getting really motivated to come to the United States, and so that's when I decided to go to the United States Military Academy.
So that's what I was going to ask you then. So why Army? Like, I asked you that, and I know the answer. It's a family thing. Your dad
no,
is
no, no, no.
Your dad? What?
Yeah, my dad's in the Navy. No, I wanted to go in the Navy. I mean, I've said this 1,000 times. I've said this a bazillion times.
I never listened to you, Al.
I know. So Top Gun, saw it, said, say less. I'm going to be an F-18 pilot. It's over. I'm going to become Tom Cruise, a little bit taller, slightly larger pecs. I'm going to the Navy. I'm going to win all the wars with Goose in the back. But then when I turned, 17, I was 6'10". And so
when did this growth happen though, too?
It happened when I was 14. So I stopped growing. I was 14 years old.
You've been 6'9", 6'10", so you were 14.
Yeah, I thought I was going to be 7'6", 7'70". I was very afraid of being too tall. So I never liked being this tall because when I was 14, I was just too big. I was just too tall.
You stood out too much.
I stood out way too much. So I wanted to be in the Navy. I always thought that, I mean, the Navy has much better posts. It has a much easier and familiar lifestyle. It's always close to the ocean. I love the ocean. I love the sea. And I always thought, and I still believe that, you know, for the United States and for our mission, we want to have the strongest Navy. The Navy is the most important component of a global empire.
Yeah.
If you call it American empire, huge debate. I don't think it is, but it's very important to control the oceans and the waterways. And so I wanted to become a naval officer, but I had those two handicaps. One, that I was extremely tall. And then two, that when I did my physical to go to the Naval Academy in Germany, they told me that I was colorblind and that I couldn't see red and green to the standards of the Navy. And so all my dreams were crushed. And then one of my best friends, idiot, big time. I know. I want to be a Marine too, which is the least, you know, in terms of requirements for of IQ, you know, you got the Marines, and that's what I wanted to be. But I couldn't.
But you also say they're movie stars too.
No, the Marines. I like the Marines. The Marines are not movie stars.
Okay.
It's the other naval. It's the other naval forces and the other naval troops that do have podcasts, books, movies. You know, before they leave the military.
Okay, I got you.
But my Marines. I mean, if you give me a chance right now to be a Marine and go to Fallujah, I wouldn't hesitate. Marines to me were exactly who I wanted to be. But I couldn't be a Marine. I couldn't distinguish between a red buoy and a green buoy, which are critical to become a Marine and conduct amphibious operations. And so I went to the military academy because a lot of my friends were their parents were in the Army, and they were going to the military academy. And then I fell in love with the Army. The Army was unknown to me. I had never been to an Army base. I had not known a lot of Army soldiers. All the soldiers that I met in Rota were Marines and Naval and Air Force. But the Army has a component that is people. So in the Army, you have to know people. You have to be very intimate with your soldiers. You have to be extremely aware of where they're from. You have to be able to motivate them. You're with them. You're equal to your men. Yeah. You just have a different title, but you're exactly the same as your soldiers. Whereas in the Navy, for example, the officers eat at a different place than the enlisted. I talk a lot of crap to my dad all the time and stuff like that. But, you know, you talk about leadership. You know, when you're eating in your nice little regal room with your silver spoons and your pictures in the back. You know, and so The Army was a lot more of my personality, I thought. And then I went to West Point, and West Point changed my life. West Point is the
most. You brag about West Point, man, so much so that the Army Navy game we have to go to together. Yeah. Okay. You've bragged about that. My brother Ron, his show goes to it every year. Okay. Yeah. And he's bragged about it. And you talk about how beautiful the campus is. And
the most beautiful. It's the most beautiful. I mean, listen, all the architecture and all the places in the United States are ugly. Ugly. Stop. There's nothing. There's not a city in the United States. Maybe Savannah. Savannah, Georgia. Savannah, Georgia. Savannah is the only city.
Yeah, listen to how you say Savannah, Georgia, too. Like, come on, man.
Savannah, Georgia. Savannah is the only city in the United States that is worth going. Other than that, all the cities in the United States look exactly the same. It's a drag with a Target, TJ Maxx, McDonald's, all the same. Terrible. But
you hadn't been to Ripley, Tennessee, okay? I'm just going to throw that out there.
Terrible. Terrible. I don't like
cities. But you chose Miami. Stop.
Miami's actually the only city that is actually semi-pretty, you know, in terms of the buildings on the water and whatnot. Only one.
But this is what Al does. See, you do this, and this is why Munch went at you, and this is why we went at you so much too. Because you have these narratives that you know aren't true and
are not true.
Oh my God.
Okay. I'm going to get Italian in here. You can't compare Florence. You can't compare Milan. You can't compare Rome, Paris, London, Madrid, Barcelona. You can't compare those with Chicago or New York City with giant rats taking pizzas off the subway. There's no way. There's not the way. It's not the same, Ramon. It's not the same.
Okay, I'm hearing you. I'm hearing you, Al. Yeah. But
West Point is one of those places. I think that West Point is by far the most beautiful place in the United States. And the history being George Washington's headquarters during the Revolutionary War, the graduates, the narrative. I mean, it really embodies a part of the American personality that is extremely attractive to me. It's the quiet professional, which unfortunately I have not had the pleasure of being that quiet professional. It does have an incredible work ethic and values. And so for me, West Point was, you know, I'm not so much proud of being a West Point grad as much as I am very thankful to have gone to West Point.
Okay, that makes sense. I get that. If you guys get the back and forth now, you see why we got tight. You also see why Al was always the butt of the conversation too. I told him before we came on Thursdays on Ports Talk, we everybody had their time. Nope, it wasn't forced, but you had to hold court. And nobody held court longer than you or more than you either, Al.
I have enjoyed one of the things that you enjoy the most about both the military and the NFL is the diversity of where people come from and how men bond by completely humiliating each other. And so when you hold court, then you prevent others from
changing the narratives on you.
Yeah, changing the narratives on you. Exactly. Yeah. You talk the whole time, nobody else is gonna say anything negative.
No doubt. But the when did football get serious with you? Because I know the story and you've told it before. You ended up going into the NFL. You were trying out with Cincy as a tight end. You had to go do some tours. You did a tour or some tours, right? You come back and you sign with Philly as a D lineman. Who did you sack and who did you get that sack off of in Philly too?
Yeah, it was Ryan Mallett. It was Ryan Mallett. Rest in peace. I got to the quarterback before Brandon Graham, and I said, I'm locked in. I'm in the 53, baby. You know what I mean? Brandon Graham couldn't get there, and I got there. There's no way. And I sacked him. I mean, I think I got a horse collar, just dunked him, celebrate, pointed at the stands to my wife. You know what I mean? It was a great moment. I said, man, I got a sack in preseason. You know what I mean? But I didn't realize that I was in the last, like, 10 place, you know? I know. It was the third
place. Cleanup duty against a dude that was probably way worse than you.
No, I guess he went to Florida. He went to Florida because I remember telling Pouncey, who I got the sack on, and he said, oh, he's a Gator. And I was like, okay. Maybe that deserves a little bit of credit. But no, I started taking football seriously the moment Beecham went down. The moment Beecham went down, I was like, whoa, this is live. This is live, boys.
This is live bullets now.
This is live bullets now. Yeah, this is a lot more. Because I was going to Carnegie Mellon. When I was in practice squad, I was.
We got on to you about that, too. And that's one of those things where you were trying to better yourself in education. We trashed you for going to class.
Trash. But I mean, I never thought I was going to make it in the NFL.
So let me take you back before you go any further. I remember preseason. Did we just play Philly or something? All I remember was this. And let me know if I'm off.
Yeah.
We're out there in the practice on practice field. This is post preseason games. So we done the four games. You had got released. And I think I remember watching Kev. Was it Kevin Colbert walking you out on the practice field?
I'm not sure.
I think it was Kev.
Maybe. I remember I walked on the practice. I was a little late because I had to do all the improv.
Yes.
And the first thing I did was one-on-ones against Tuitt, right tackle, and he whiffed. And I whiffed both times. And I said, yeah, it was my first time playing tackle in forever. I was a triple option guy. I was like, I get a 3-point stand. I get a 2-point stand. What the hell are you doing? Get a 2-point.
From wide receiver to tight end to D-line to tackle. I remember watching you walk out to the practice field. And I'm thinking to myself, who the hell is that dude? And you're tall as hell. I'm like, what are we going to do with him? Little did I know, we was going to play years next to each other. Like
right,
you said,
right.
Yeah, crazy, man. So your introduction to Pittsburgh was what, though?
My introduction to Pittsburgh was... I got cut from Philly, and then I'm at the public library in my in-law's house learning how to do a resume. My resume is like two lines. It's like Army, you know, I'm a major. Like, I don't know what can I explain, you know, anybody? I don't know what I'm going to be working on. I was contacting headhunters to see if I could, you know, get a medical sales job or something. And Coach Tomlin called me. And you know how Coach Tomlin calls you on the phone? You feel like you're talking to the most, like, hypersonic, you know, charismatic human being in the world. He's like,
he captivates you.
He captivates you with a phone call. And he said, hey, we want to bring you out here for a workout. And so I went to Philly. I went to Pittsburgh. Drove by myself. I did a workout. I worked out with John Mitchell. I did a D-line workout. And he looked at Coach Tommy and said, "Like, yeah, he's too slow. He's not gonna be able to get off the ball fast." And then they passed me. And then they passed me to Munchak. And Munchak started doing all these drills, all these the individual Munch drills, you know. And he said, "It was kind of like, yeah, I'll take him." You know what I mean? Kind of like.
Yeah.
You guys going to throw them away? I'll take them, you know?
So what's fascinating about Munch, Munch is very interested in the service. That's do you think that played a part in it too, as far as like, if he was a soldier, I can train him?
Yes, for sure. I think that the baby boomers all had a, you know, a lot of them missed. I mean, this is my theory. So a lot of them missed Vietnam by a few years. So Munchak missed Vietnam by the draft, you know, in Pennsylvania. Yeah. I watched the movie because he told me to watch it. He said, watch the movie The Deer Hunter. And I was like, oh, I'll watch it. And so The Deer Hunter was a very good representation of what Pennsylvania was like during the Vietnam era, where you either went to the mills and you worked in the South Side, working on Carson Street in these giant mills, or you went to Vietnam, you know?
Yeah.
And so the Vietnam War was not very popular, rightfully so. Imagine a Vietnam right now in 2023.
It would
be a disaster. But for a lot of people, it was the sense of duty of serving for your country, just like it is. Just like it is now. And so the service became very entangled with football, and a lot of coaches just love the military. So the only reason why I got with Philly is because Chip Kelly loved the military as well.
Wow.
And Munchak wanted to be a soldier, and that's the one thing that he wanted to do. And so I think there was always a little bit of admiration from the coaches who committed their life to Diet Pepsi and Copenhagen and thousands of hours of meeting, going over the same protection for the rest of their lives, and a life that they could have had they gone to the service.
Yeah, that makes sense, man. And you're right. When Beach got hurt, like, it got serious for you. What?
Yeah.
I wasn't an asshole, was I? I wasn't that bad, was I?
I think you have to be bad because you want to make sure that, you know, for example, I was thinking about this on my way here. One of the funniest things between you and I, one of the things that we were able to navigate in our friendship was tripping each other. How do you not trip each other? Because you know how bad, how bad it looks when you're doing an amazing set. And you got him.
Yeah.
But you just all of a sudden you're on your back.
Yeah.
It looks ugly. It looks hopefully he falls on you. But if he falls on you, you drag him with you. It's a hold.
It's a holding call.
And if he sacks the quarterback, it's going to be a reel over and over again. You'll
never live it down.
Forever. So as an offensive lineman, the tackle guard have to make sure that they don't trip each other. And for us, I remember that the first game, so it was a half game against Arizona, Dwight Freeney, no big deal. But then the second game, it was against Kansas City, and they like to do a lot of twists.
Sure did.
And you and I got beat on a couple of twists on the backside of five-man protection, good old 53 protection. Good old 53!
They're sliding and leaving us. Yeah. Right.
And so we had to get, you and I had to work together about finding our depth and finding our sets in order not to trip each other. And that's when I started becoming very close to you and just doing the vertical set in order to avoid tripping each other and being able to pass off the twist, which was the biggest thing that I didn't want to let you down. I didn't want the five technique to spear you, and I did not want you to have to take a huge step to the left to pass me the defensive tackle, because then you would step on me and then I would fall.
Yep. You're right. And I never forget Munch breaking it down to us in meetings and stuff, and just over and over. Then we'll go from there to the practice field, and he'll, oh my God, I loved and hated it, because he did little things, like you said, that Army stuff.
Yeah.
The last push, you know what I'm saying? The extra rep and all those. Yes. But that's how he made us play, though, too. And I think it's super unique of all the dudes I played with on that side, whether it was somebody older than me, whether it was Beecham, whether me and Gil on the right side and stuff like that. Ours was the most unique because we were big as heck. I'm talking about height-wise, size-wise, like you couldn't miss it. Leg-wise, like all of that was huge, and having to get used to you and your movements. And honestly, learning, you were still learning a lot.
Oh, but I asked you the snap count. You remember that was crazy how every single time it's almost insane. I wouldn't even listen to the huddle. I was like, I'm going to double check with Ramon. And then I became used to it. Yeah. I became used to it where I would listen to the play one time, but I was like, I'm going to verify with Ramon on the way to the line of scrimmage. And then we would say like 35. And then you and I would say like 30,000 times. Monday.
Yeah, Monday.
Yeah, so we would be on the same page. And then as we progressed and as we started playing with each other, then we started getting all the fake calls like crazy. You know what I mean? Then we got savvy. Then we became savvy vets. And then we started having fun together for sure.
We did, man. But it was dope to actually kind of watch you grow up, though. And me too, because we both were still growing in the same point. When Munch came in for all of us, right. I think it was crucial. Pounce benefited. You did. Dave did. Gil did. Everybody that listened benefited from it. And think about all the dudes that was in that room that left that room and got paid. Matt Filer, the anchor. Him, Hub. Okay, Finney ended up going somewhere else. Just the dudes that were around that were in it benefited from it. And we had a super, super dope group, man. With a lot of different personalities.
We went to breakfast, to the couches, the meetings, the 3 hours of laps, to the walkthrough with Ben, post-practice. I mean, we were together 24-7. It was amazing. What an incredible era, for sure.
One thing I try to explain to this fan base, this group that's watching us now, man. Shout out to you guys. Hit that like and subscribe button too while y'all still in here, okay?
Yeah, hit the like and subscribe.
Why are they playing around, Al?
Yeah, hit the like and subscribe. Move on from here.
What the hell are we doing, man? People ask the question, how do we get so close? Like, this wasn't an overnight thing. It happens through reps, as you said. You walk into the line, you're going, Moan, what is it? Or Al, hey, Monday, Tuesday. It was meetings. The way we challenge each other a lot.
Oh yeah. If you had a bad rep.
Oh my.
During individual, there'd be silence in the room, and Munchak will just play over and over again, and then Pouncey will say something so ignorant and demeaning, and demoralizing, and then you just want Earth to swallow you, and you want it to disappear and die in that second. You'd say like, I don't want to. Before you play that rep one more time, just make it go away. You know, just disappear from our fleece.
But see, the thing was, though, if it was something that was correctable, he did that. We all had, at one point in time, one really bad play. and we know it's coming up, and months should go past it.
Depends on how established you were, you know, and depends on whether you need it or not. Pouncey, he would never show Pouncey.
He wouldn't.
He wouldn't even make him do one-on-ones.
What's crazy? Go ahead.
No, the one-on-ones, Pouncey not doing one-on-ones, that is the biggest, like, what the hell are we doing here? You know what I mean? Nobody wants to do one-on-ones. You know, who wants to do one-on-ones on week 16 of the season on four pads, you know what I mean, two reps against a young buck? You know, who wants to do that? You know, Pouncey fit him out. And he was always encouraging people, you know? And when the defense would win, it would be like, oh, got him in the mix here. I'm like, what are you talking about, man? You're with us, bro.
You're supposed to be with us. Yeah. What's crazy, and we say this all the time, and Pounce admitted it on here, the only reason I'll say it, Munch used to fuss at me and you for something that Pounce did or that Dave did.
All the time. It was the golden child. Don't say anything, you know what I mean?
He operated, though, too. That's some crazy stuff right there, man. In that, though, what I was getting to originally was what we had in Pittsburgh and how we built it, the whole Goons mantra that Coach T kind of ran with in public and everybody else took on, too. For this young group that they have in Pittsburgh now, if you're watching the game, and I know you do a lot of other stuff besides watch football, it takes time is what I've been telling people. When you look at Dan Moore, when you look at Broderick Jones, Isaac Simalo, I think you know him from Philly, if I'm not mistaken. But a line, Al, either way, it takes time to build up what we had.
It does, but I mean, it also takes. I mean, we had an amazing quarterback, you know what I mean, and we knew which plays. I mean, we knew which play. I remember Gil would always ask Ben during practice whether a play was going to be like a quick pass or a long pass, and so then we also. I mean, I remember Gil and I would study the route concepts, and then because we knew that if a quarterback holds the ball or if it's a quick throw, then you can become more aggressive. You can jump set your guy. You know that even if you whiff, the ball's going to be out. And then you knew the other protections, like 74, you know, versus a seven-man blitz was going to be a lot more challenging, and you had to change your sets. So I think, obviously, Ben helped a lot in this. Ben matured a lot, I think, from his previous years getting sacked every other play to protecting himself. Yeah. So I think it was a collective effort. And then, obviously, the Steelers mentality was very beneficial to us of trying to keep us together. It was unfortunate that we weren't able to achieve more success as a group together. You know, and, you know, that is the only unfortunate part, because then we would have been celebrating together, you know, for eternity. Yeah. But I thought it was a combination. I thought it was a Steeler way. I thought it was Munchak, Coach Tomlin. It was Ben. It was the running backs who were also incredible. D'Angelo Williams. That was a laugher too.
He was. That's our guy.
You're right. Le'Veon. You know, we just had amazing personnel on offense, and when everything is clicking, then the offensive line shines. So I don't think we should take all the credit either, Ramon.
No, absolutely.
We had Todd Haley too, you know. We were stacked, you know, and we all worked very well together. The protections were great. They made a lot of sense. I was fortunate enough to be part of other systems where they teach protections and be able to verify that how pragmatic Munchak was in being able to distribute the responsibility and be able to help the guys who needed it was instrumental for the success of the O-line.
Somebody got a question. It's a good one. I just had it start to Al. There's comments on the side of here. A lot of people saying stuff. They glad to see you. A lot of people saying thank you for your service and everything too, man. But yeah, Ax, when you retired, you said to this something to the effect that you would not miss playing the game. I feel the same way too. Do you still feel that way, or do you miss it?
My thing is it's impossible for me to play, like to conceive, you know, playing the game of football right now.
I don't even watch it the same.
No, my body works. I watch the game of football and I'm just like, ooh.
I know, I do the same. Ooh. Yes, yes.
I hear the clacking of the helmets and I'm like, ooh.
Yes.
I'm sensitive now. There's no way. I'm 255, you know. My hands are nice and soft. There's no way. We appreciate it while it lasted. In my situation, I was extremely fortunate that I was able to play football, because my odds would have been, you know, there's no way that someone like me should have been playing football right now, or have a career in the NFL. And once you retire, and obviously with age, then I don't think I could play two plays in the NFL right now. So
you can't fake football.
No, you can't fake football. You gotta be all in. Your muscles gotta be tight. And I don't even think about the possibility of playing football. You know,
this is unique right here too, man, from Kenneth, and I think it's super unique, Al. And just a little bit of explanation. Can you talk about your development? We got Al's development from practice squad to starter, and also Pro Bowler. So we got to throw that in there. Did I know you were going to be that good? I didn't know what you were going to be. I'm going to be honest with you. And probably the same way a lot of people feel about me. And I saw somebody a second ago said, you know, two-fifths of that that offensive line was undrafted. That was me and you, like, having to find our way, Al. Like, there it is right there.
Crazy Filer. Thing. Filer for a year was undrafted, too.
There was the anchor. Yeah. The anchor, man. I saw him in Tampa this year, dude. It was so good seeing him, man.
He's so large. Like, when you retire and you see an NFL player, you're like, geez, you guys are big, bro.
You know who did it for me? It wasn't even a big dude. It was Minka.
Say Minka.
Minka's neck.
I know. I went fishing with Minka, and I was like, damn, Minka. You know what I mean? Like, it was crazy how big he is. I see Minka all the time. He comes out here in the offseason.
Yeah, that's what he said. He's down in Miami in the offseason.
No, it's crazy.
But how was that development? Because you had to gain a lot of weight. And
my development was, somebody told me when I was in the Army, they love the military so much that they'll, even if they give you 1 year in the system, you'll make enough money to go to business school and then you can continue on with your life. So my only goal was to go into a business school and move on with my life. The transition from being a military veteran, a military active duty personnel to a veteran, is the hardest transition. And you've experienced the transition to go from a football player into a civilian. And you know how difficult and challenging it is. And the military is 30,000 times harder. And so for me, when I was in practice squad, I was way more concerned about being able to go into a good university. And in this case, it was Carnegie Mellon. And I thought I was going to know you guys. And then you guys will be playing football and I'll be at school. And then maybe, you know, every now and then I'll be able to say hi to you if I ever saw you on the shady side or whatnot. But I never thought I was going to be playing football. Now, the good thing is that Munchak was an incredible coach. So if you just show up to work and you try to absorb from the culture of you know, you, Pouncey, Gill, the Beecham, who was – Beecham was my biggest inspiration. Yeah. Beecham is the player that I have – emulated my game. You know, I always thought, well, you know, I want to be like Jason Peters. But when I saw Beecham play, I said, this dude, he is the most proficient in the tackle technique. He prepares the best out of any professional that I've ever seen. He cares the most. And I have never, and I learned everything from him. The high hip double team move, that was Beecham. The trap move when somebody would try to elongate their arms, that was Beecham. The jump set, every single thing that I learned was from Kelvin Beecham. So my development from practice squad standpoint was watching Beecham and saying, man, if Beecham can do it, I should have no excuse whatsoever to be able to play in the National Football League, hopefully for another team.
Because to your point, he was undersized. He had long arms, but he had to do all of those things. To where some guys are born with the stuff, and it comes easier.
Right. But it wasn't just that. It was just his preparation, like the way he would watch film. He was biting his nails the entire time watching film. You know, he created a level of anxiety to himself in order to play. He had a lot less room for error than larger human beings that were playing at the same position. And so I started picking up everything from him, from psyching myself up with a pass rusher to being able to rank guys and develop strategies. Beecham was the guy that allowed that whole transition possible. And, you know, because I had not just Beecham, but I also have Mike Adams in front of me. I always thought that it was going to be impossible for me to play for the Pittsburgh Steelers. I never saw it as a viable option.
And a stabbing and an injury later, and you're right in there.
Right. It was crazy. I mean, the odds are very, very slim, and so that's why I never prepare myself mentally to have a career in the NFL that would be, you know, just based on football. I always thought the football was going to be complementary, just like my education at West Point or university. Football would complement me and be able to help me, you know, move on with life.
Danny asks, can you talk about playing against the Steelers and being a Raven real quick? What was, because I know they trash talked you so bad. I know somebody who said something. Anybody? TJ no, said nothing.
Okay. Who is TJ going to say during the game? First of all, he plays on the other side. You know what I mean? You want to come with the real boys? Come out here to the left side. You know?
That's you gonna tell them that?
No. I tell anybody. You know what I mean?
I'm messing with you. Yeah.
I never went, so I had to go against Alex Highsmith, who's the nicest, kindest, most amazing human being on the planet. He's not gonna talk smack. Chris Wormley was a Raven. He's not gonna, and then well, Cam, I'll tell him, you know what I mean? Like, what is Cam gonna say? Cam is the nicest guy, you know, he's not gonna say anything. And then the other one was Devin Bush. Devin Bush is the man, you know, like you can say a lot, but you can't hate. What are you gonna? Are you willing to engage in a conversation with me? Are you willing to get into my area of dominion? You know, are you willing to battle me with words? Oh no, that's the last.
You're good at it.
Yeah,
you'll speak Spanish on them. Yeah.
Yeah, but the feeling was very surreal. It was very weird. Obviously, going to Pittsburgh, I really wanted to win so bad, but there is something. There's something, and I noticed the insecurity in the Ravens facility when it was time to play the Steelers. And it was very similar to when the Patriots players would come to us and they would say, bro, we can beat them. You know what I mean? We can beat the Patriots. They're not all that. But for the Ravens, the Steelers have their number. You know, Coach Tomlin knows how to play a defense. The rattles Lamar. He's blitzing nonstop. The coaches for Steeler Week, they act different. That transmits to the players. I was trying to tell them, no, you know what I mean? Stay disciplined, you know, we'll get them, you know. But it was impossible. The Steelers know exactly how to play the Ravens. And so, yeah, we lost both. I mean, they lost this year, you know, twice again. You know,
yeah, twice again.
Right.
That's fascinating you say that. I always kind of say that to folks, too. Is there were that week is special right there. In Pittsburgh versus Baltimore. We could go on about that one. What were you about to say?
It's not special. It's not.
To me, it was. See, you went to both sides. To me, it was.
No game.
You didn't think it was in Pittsburgh, those night games?
To me, because I matched up very well against Terrell Suggs. And so for me, the game was not.
Okay, that's different.
Was not as difficult. When they had, who's the guy that went to Green Bay?
Za'Darius Smith.
Za'Darius, when he was coming up, he was a challenge. But fortunately for me, he was only there for 3 years. We always matched up well against Baltimore. Maybe on the other side of the ball, they ran the ball more, la la la, whatever. But for us, for me specifically, that was not as challenging as it was for the interior. The interior had to go against heavyweights, you know.
Yeah.
But
it's different me, on for, the inside.
For me, what I remember was Cincinnati. Cincinnati was the rivalry where I would get the jitters and I would get like the full body adrenaline shots when we had to play that defensive line of Gilberry, Michael Johnson, Geno,
Don Lapp.
Yeah,
with all the linebackers too.
Yeah, the linebackers were very good. They just had a very, very good defense. 4-3 is a lot harder, you know what I mean? Because they just keep coming. I thought Philly was a very tough defense too, but I never thought that the Baltimore game was going to be very. I mean, I knew my whole in-laws were going to be in the stands. You know, Maryland is a state that I've spent a lot of time in, so I feel almost at home in Maryland. And it was never that weird to me. It was weird that it was a rivalry. I was like, why? What is this a rivalry? You know what I mean? But both cities are exactly the same.
What turned Cincinnati into what it was, in your opinion? Us and since and that what was that 3-4 years?
Yeah, so I thought it was the defensive coordinator who coached in Minnesota. Forgot his name.
Look that up for you. I'll find his name here.
Yeah, I'm horrible with names, but Zimmer. Yeah, Zimmer had the 4-3 double barrel. The double barrel was something that created a lot of stress and angst to Munchak, and it was a defense that was extremely difficult to stop for me, because as a tackle, you had to have your eyes on the A-gap to see if the linebacker was going to blitz. And if he blitzed, you had to get the three technique. So that was very uncomfortable.
And we had to communicate a lot in those games.
A lot. And then they had Andy Dalton, who's a very, very good quarterback, underrated quarterback. A.J. Green. A.J. Green, he just like you, man. It was amazing, amazing. They had Eifert. So they were stacked. They had an amazing, amazing team.
And Giovanni,
Giovanni Bernard. Yeah, they just for me the tough game was going to be since I hate it was cleaner looks to play a 4-3 defense, but it was way more physical and it was a lot more challenging because they built their team around their defense. And I always remember the Cincinnati game as being the most challenging game that we played.
I remember, of course, Shazier's situation, AB getting knocked out. Like it was a few times we were on that field and we was like, "What the heck is going on?"
Right. I always felt with Baltimore, we were boys. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
We were way cooler with Baltimore.
That's because you and Suggs laughed and had a good time on the outside. And yeah, I got to give it to him. Pearson was cool up the middle.
Yeah.
They weren't. CJ it was more Mosley, respect.
CJ. Yeah, CJ. Mosley, cool. It wasn't like Cincinnati.
It was respect. No,
Cincinnati,
it was respect.
Cincinnati was a lot rougher. I mean, we had a lot of respect with the D-line guys, but everybody else, Pac-Man Jones, you know, Kirkpatrick, you know, that was a lot more. That was a lot more animosity in it. But Baltimore, I mean, we were always talking on the side, you know, in between, you know, with Humphreys, you know, and all these little laughers too. And they have a very, very similar culture and they build almost the same way as the Steelers. So, I found it to be an incredible organization and an amazing, a part of my journey into the National Football League for sure.
No doubt. Speaking of your journey, too, this one comes up real quick, and that one we'll tiptoe around to however we have to the conversation in Chicago. You want to have that one? I got to ask you first. You mind?
Yeah, I mean, I don't know. I mean, you can.
I just the way it happened wasn't how you planned it to happen or the team.
No, right.
For some reason, people don't want to believe that. People think that you did it on your own. You got plastered as one thing that you weren't. On message boards that you wouldn't. Yeah. So I've told it before. Like, it didn't go the way the media, me being on the media side now, you guys always made fun of me about that. So me being on the media side now, I see how narratives can be written. That the truth is cool. But the story is way bigger. So let's go with this story.
Right. That's why never, you know, there was a lot of opportunities and a lot of things that happened afterwards that would have changed my life in terms of, you know, people, opportunities and whatnot. But I try to tell you, I was like, there was no message there. I'm not trying to do anything. I'm not trying to tell anybody anything. I could care less if people do cartwheels during the national anthem. I'd much rather live in a country that allows you to do whatever you want. The one that forces you to do something, you know, to live in a dystopian society where you have to do something in America to me seems surreal. But the confusion did create an unwanted and unnecessary because I mean, doing this for you, you know, I don't have social media. I would never claim to know the truth about anything. Matter of fact, the more I learn and the more I mature in my life, the more I realize that I know less. And I guess wise enough to know that and experienced enough to have been to many different parts of the world where they view things completely different. I know why America is what it is. And a lot of people try to tell me what America is. And, you know, it's like, how do you know America if you've never lived anywhere else? You know what I mean? How do you know you want to only play for one coach if you've never played for anybody else? You know, to me, it's just not a pragmatic answer. And so when it happened, I remember I remember making this comment to Munchak. I said, somebody sent me it was in like an alt-right
an extremist group.
It was on a kind of alt-right media thing. And I said, man, I'm gonna tell these people that I'm an illegal immigrant, so maybe they take me out. You know what I mean? Like, oh, we're conflicted now. What can we do about this?
That's what's so crazy about you. Your name is Alejandro Villanueva. Nobody you speak knows how many anything. Languages?
Nobody knows anything about my life. Nobody even bought. They call me Al, Ali. You know, that's how the people are like, you guys don't understand. I don't speak English. You know what I mean? Like, this is my second language. I'm pretending to act like an American right now. This is not who I am. I have a view of America where patriotism is not being nationalistic. It's not being, I'm better than you, this is the best. It's more, I've always admired American patriotism because of gratitude, because people are very thankful to be in America. Whether it's the best country in the world or not, it's incredibly debatable. Somebody in France, somebody in Switzerland will tell you, oh, you guys are Americans, oh, you guys have whatever. But Americans are very thankful to be Americans. And when you're thankful to be American, that's all it takes. You don't have to say, I'm better than everybody else. That's what they do in Germany. That's what they do in Spain. That's what they do in France. That's what they do in England. But this, we're Americans. We're not a nation. We're an idea. And it's this idea that is up to you to realize. And so I was always extremely respectful of everyone's opinions on the team regarding a very sensitive situation. And I remember I told you, I said, Ramon, regardless of the truths and the facts, because we could debate them and they were very sensitive. The fact that somebody shows up to the facility feeling if somebody showed up
to the facility. You went out for a second. If you said the fact that somebody showed up to the facility feeling what?
Right. You know, during that period of time, the fact that somebody shows up to the facility and they are sad about the circumstances surrounding their own country, to me is enough. It's like, dude, how can I change your feelings? How can I debate how you feel? This is how you feel. This is who you are. This is your narrative. And I have to respect that 1,000%. When it came to the national anthem, I also have the unique circumstance that to me, the military in America offered me an incredible way of life. And I will be so thankful for the rest of my life, for this country, for the ability to have been attended to West Point, for the ability to have met so many different troops from so many different places, for the ability to play football and get to know the United States. For me, I was very thankful for that. And so as a soldier, I had a completely different point of view as everybody else. And so I wanted to respect everybody's views. I told the team leadership, you know, I told this 1,000 times. I've realized that there's no, I mean, I'm not trying to gain anything out of this. It's like I'm never going to write a book about this.
You actually hated it.
I hate attention. Attention is the worst. You know, it's you gain nothing out of it. You know, once you get to the top, all you're going to go goes down. You know what I mean? Like, well, what's the point of fame? You know, my life is very simple. I'm with my family, with my bros. I don't owe anything to anybody. There's something beautiful about that. I don't have to impress anybody. I can let my beard grow. I can do whatever. So when that happened, a lot of people from the organization came out and just say, you know, we should have done this the other better. Sure, whatever. It could have been handled at a different hindsight 2020 for sure. But from my perspective, I tried not to be alone and I tried not to have the cameras in front of me. The fact that the cameras showed up and they were there
was they very blacked out. It was edited. The tunnel darkness highlighted you and put us behind. Yeah, and I was just But those are narratives, though.
Yeah, I would never investigate. I would never, I think it's too. There's not nothing's gonna come out of it. Nothing reaching the bottom truth of as to why I was left alone, and you know, I didn't have the captains next to me like they told me they were gonna be, or why did certain people didn't come out with me, or what? Who cares? It happened, you know. Yeah. I remember forgetting about it the next day, or obviously the next day was a lot more difficult, but you know, trying to move on and say, if you don't pay attention to it, it'll go away. And it went away. You know, and a lot of times if I do people, oh, you're the guy that's to the national anthem. It's like I engage in meaningless conversations throughout my entire life because I'm 6'10". And every single time I'm going to walk into a place, somebody's going to say, how tall are you? Do you play basketball? How can you find clothes? You fit in your car. La, 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 la. So now I just have to add another, you know, sort of meaningless conversation regarding the national anthem, which at the end of the day is, you know, if you're thankful to be an American, that's amazing. That's awesome. If you have other feelings, then, you know, you're more than welcome to be in this country as well, because in this country, we want diversity of opinions. The moment we become monogamous into how we all think and how we all act, then we would not be American. We'll become a nation. And then at that point, we have no advantages over Eurasia and other countries in the world that can, you know, ship products amongst themselves, and they can do things a lot more efficient than this isolated continent away from the rest of the world.
Love it, man. I told him I might ask you one thing. I saw you on a plane one time when we were leaving. And you said the only time you get nervous is when we fly. And then you told us at Porch Talk, why? Your last mission. You mind going through that one? You were nervous to fly?
Well, I don't like flying. A lot of people don't like flying. You know, first of all, you know, I don't like flying. I don't like getting blood either. You know, we can go through all my my fears in life and my phobias. I don't like flying. My dad is a pilot. You know, and has always told me like.
But you jumped out of planes.
Yeah, and that's even worse. Jumping out of planes. Jumping out of planes is the worst thing I've ever done with full consent.
with full consent.
For sure. The worst thing that I've ever done in my life is jumping out of airplanes.
Same way you can't watch football, you can't think about jumping out of a plane no more.
I'm going to say it right now. Jumping out of airplanes is something that the military has because we did it in World War II. There is no way. I will bet right now. I don't want to bet, there's no way we're going to jump into combat again. You know, like if you saw how low these planes fly, if you realize that, you know, total warfare is not effective anymore, it's a thing that we do it's a gut check, you know.
It's the 82nd
jumps, the Rangers jump, you know, we jump, we're airborne. Oh, look how many people have put a comment in there, we're airborne. Yeah. Airborne is cool, it's tight. You know, I hate jumping. You know, jumping is the worst. So flying was very stressful because when I was in Afghanistan, my second tour in 2013, I was going to go to the gym because we had a reverse schedule. So we would wake up at around 6 o'clock in the afternoon and then we would go work out, dinner for breakfast, which is amazing. And then we would go into the tactical operations center. We'll get briefed on the missions and whatever. And there was a plane, a 747, that was taken off at Bagram Airfield. And I remember seeing a 747 take off at Bagram. And I said, man, that's kind of weird that there's a 747. A 747 is a decommissioned civilian plane. Like, I wonder what this plane is doing here. And I saw it take off, and it was going very slow, and it paused in the air, and then it crashed right in front of me. And I remember I was watching it go down, and I started running, like, I want to save these people. And then I just saw this giant ball of fire, and I was like, well, I guess I'm going to go to the gym and do legs now. You know, there's nothing I can do now. And so that was one. And then the next deployment, on my last mission, we went out to a valley in Wardak called Chaki Wardak, and we had to walk in the snow forever, and we had to find I don't know if I'm allowed to talk about, you know, tactical operation procedures, but basically there was a building that we had to go investigate because like 15 adult males had gone into it. And we went in there, and when we saw it, it was a well. I was like, man, this is a well. This is not a building. You know what I mean? There's nothing here. And we just kept on the radio. No, that's it. We're flashing on it, going there, going, ah, man, there's nothing here. So we spent all night there trying to figure out. We dropped grenades. We did everything. You know, it's just a well. And then when we left the mission, it was like, well, there's nothing we can do here. We got RPGs fired at us as we were loading the Chinooks to get out.
Which is the helicopter.
The helicopter, right. You have billions of them out there at Fort Campbell. You know, they were probably from Fort Campbell as well in Tennessee. And when the helicopter took off, then it started going to an evasive maneuver. And so it started shaking. And yeah, it was one of those things where you see things in slow motion. You think of all the, you're like, man, I should have not watched Final Destination 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, and 6. You know, I should have not watched all these videos from gore.com and Live League, you know, all these years. I should have never done this. But somehow we were able to manage. But helicopters, when they're going through these maneuvers, man, they feel the up and down and they feel the movement a lot more than a plane. And so every single time you recognize that on a plane, when especially landing in Pittsburgh is a very awkward landing because you have to go west to east most of the time, yeah. facing against the eastern winds. The pilots sometimes, they're like, oh, I got the Pittsburgh Steelers. I'm going to show them this maneuver right here. And I was like, no, take it easy. Take it easy. Take it easy. I got all the time in the world to get home. Take it easy. But it would get bumpy and it would get very sketchy. It would get very sketchy. And I would always, get in a full sweat, and Dave would be laughing at me the whole time, and, fortunately nothing has happened. So, but flying is not one of my favorite things for sure.
Speaking of Dave, we had a few folks ask the question, who's a better fisherman, you or him?
Dave?
Yeah, between you and Dave.
You better fisherman. You categorizing Dave as a fisherman?
Well, he was your fishing buddy.
Yeah, he's a guest. He's a good fishing guest. You know what I mean? He's not a fisherman.
I can't wait to tell him you crap talking him, man.
No, he's not gonna debate that. David's not gonna debate that. I'm the greatest fisherman that has ever, I'm the best.
Come down to Miami, man.
I'm the best. There's no one else that can outfish me.
Stop it. We'll see, man. One of the things too you always said about Afghanistan too, or overseas when you were touring. You said two things that was super unique to me. And I was like, yeah, right. You said some of the best fruits you ever had came from Afghanistan. And you said some of the best fried chicken you ever had came out of that area.
Hands down. So I actually call my farm Kandahar Farms. So my farm is called Kandahar Farms. And people down here in Miami can't pronounce the name at all. You know what I mean? Whatsoever. But Kandahar is one of the oldest cities in Western, well, I guess you cannot consider Western civilization, but it's one of the oldest cities in civilization. It was founded by Alexander the Great. In their language, it was Iskandar, and then it later got translated to Kandahar. And Kandahar is one of the most amazing places that I've ever been to. And everybody knows that, well, I wouldn't say everybody knows, but if you grow fruit in very dry environments, they usually tend to get very sweet. Okay. And so the fruit there, the pomegranates, the grapes, apples, anything that you ate off the ground, which now that I'm a farmer, I'm like, yeah, I know why they were putting bombs everywhere. You know, I got these 70 goons walking through my fields, taking all the fruit. You know what I mean? What do you think? I want to welcome them with open arms, in my country. We're savage in their fields, And so, Kandahar Kandahar is, you can't travel there. You're not going to find Instagram reels or some girl going there with her boyfriend, dragging him by the hand, going like, oh, look at these mountains of the Hindu Kush. You can't go to Afghanistan. Afghanistan is an extremely dangerous country, but it is beautiful because it's so rare. And the people there live like you're in the Bible. I mean, they live out of houses made out of mud, extremely conservative beyond anything that you've ever seen. No music, no games. Yeah. Very rural, very, the Afghans are insanely tough, and the way that they cook was very rudimentary, and they would, kill a chicken right there that was running around the yard. They would make him in an hour with some rice and some incredible ingredient. And a lot of it is, I'm a huge fan of Indian food, So if you like Indian food, you can imagine what it's like to eat something that is of that nature in the Pakistan, Afghanistan, Indian region. It is insane, amazing food. Afghanistan has an incredible culture. Obviously, I don't agree with a lot of their practices, but I'm more of an Anthony Bourdain who likes to go out there to try their food, explore a little bit to see how they live their life, and then don't make no judgments whatsoever. Take what you can, enjoy it, add it to your perspective and experiences in life, and then move on. And so for me, it wasn't fried chicken like they do in the South, obviously. You know what I mean? With canola oil and incredible breading. And
some flour and everything.
Yeah. It wasn't like that, but it was very, very delicious. I remember the chicken and the lamb there in Afghanistan were incredible.
No doubt about it, man. So I've been telling folks, of course, man, you have somehow taken credit for Mason's reemergence.
Mason 100%.
Rudolph. No, 100%. See, this is the thing right here, Al. You always do this.
I'm him.
No, you're not him. Okay, you used to be. Now you're just you. Okay, you're not him anymore. Okay, where's Marquise when you see what I'm saying? Like, you need humbling. Like, no.
Mason was part of the Breakfast Club, which is your
career. Was,
and he liked to get abused, and so because he liked to get abused, he was part of the Brodies.
We would
crush him, you know what I mean? But I thought, my thing was this. When I saw Mason play that game against the Cleveland Browns.
Cleveland Browns, okay.
Yes.
You're talking about the one we were in?
Yes. And he went through that whole episode. And again, there's microphones everywhere. There's Matt Filer, who has never told a lie in his life.
Yeah, get to it.
You know what I mean? He went through that episode that was such a challenging, difficult moment in his life.
Hold that moment right there. When people ask that question, how Mason got buried, how Mason was put on the back burner, and the narrative that he couldn't play football, your point has been made as the same as mine. Stuff transpired from that game that changed the outlook on him.
1,000%. He went through that, and then a year later, the year of COVID, the last game of the season, we're playing the Browns. We play the Browns the week after in the playoffs, and we got smashed. But that last game, Coach Tomlin said, yeah, Ben, out. Ramon, out. You know, Dave, out. And so I'm like, you kidding me? I'm playing out here this game with who, man? You know? But Mason was playing that game. Mason is starting the game.
We did get golden tickets.
You got the golden ticket.
I got a golden ticket that day.
Yeah, you were giving me water on the sidelines. Yeah, you got it, bro. You know what I mean? You were giving me the iPad. What do you want? An iPad? You want a hoodie?
You need a blanket?
You need a blanket? Yeah. So when I remember thinking to myself, man, this gotta be hard. This has to be difficult for anybody to go through this and then face Myles Garrett at home to go to the playoffs. If the Browns won the game, they were going to the playoffs. And then half the starters for the Steelers are not there. And we almost won that game. And Mason played an incredible game. Incredible game. You know what I mean? It was just amazing to see him so poised. So, American football, in my opinion, is made to inspire American culture. And American culture thrives on people under pressure, like Tom Cruise, you know, when everything's on the line, you know, you say, like, I got you, goose, you know what I mean? And you save the day. That is what American football is made for. That's why quarterbacks can only be evaluated when they're playing under pressure.
When they're playing under pressure.
It's the only way that you can evaluate a quarterback. If you evaluate a quarterback when you got an offensive line and you run the ball all day and you never have to be challenged in protections and people are scared of the run game and they're not scared of you in 2 minutes, you know, then, you know, the quarterback is okay. You know what I mean? Right. But he's not going to be a quarterback that people want to watch. People want to watch Tom Brady on a 2-minute drill to win the game. People want to watch Peyton Manning say, Omaha, Omaha, change the route and, you know, make the touchdown. So, When I saw Mason Rudolph play that game, I was very inspired. I was very proud of him. And at that moment, I thought, he has something that a lot of people don't have, and that is guts. You know, he's got guts. He's poised. I remember when he first started, the famous words from Coach Munchak that I shall not repeat, you know, this kid has got a lot of accuracy, you know. He's got amazing talents.
Yeah, oh, my God.
But he proved that once he learned the game, his head was he became a complete quarterback. And then unfortunately for him, you know, situations got ugly. They signed a backup quarterback for a large sum of money, and you and I know what happens when you sign somebody for, you know, it's just,
they gotta play.
You gotta play and you gotta put him in there. And obviously they drafted a quarterback as well. And so Mason was completely overlooked by the organization. I don't think it was intentional. I think it was just.
That's what I was gonna say. You can't say it's intentional. It's just how the game goes.
It's just it's standard procedure in the NFL. When Mason will come down during, you know, think about it. Like, the Breakfast Club is over. You know, Mason. There's no more Breakfast Club anymore. Even Zach Banner is gone. You know what I mean? So there's no. He doesn't have a sidekick. You know, he's from a different era. He's got to go hang out with TJ and Cam, you know what I mean? Like with the old guys. Because Mason now has been in the organization for many years.
think the longer. No, with Cam, TJ, Mason.
Yeah. So when he would come down, he would always, you know, Miami's the mecca for NFL players when they want to spend money and forget about life, you know. And so he would come here like a renegade, and we would talk. And I could see that his IQ as a quarterback had developed tremendously, because I would try to test him. You know, I would try to question him on themes about offensive line play regarding protections and adjustments and whatnot. And man, he got it. He knew it all. You know, he was speaking now at a very high level within the game of football. And so that's when I became a sports psychologist, and that's why I deserve all the credit. That's why, you know, Coach Tomlin owes me a check or something. You know what I mean?
I'm going to have DK save this clip and play this live for Mason tomorrow, because he's coming on. And the fact that you said you saved Mason, I need to see his reaction to this.
Yeah, he's going to laugh. Ha, 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 ha. No, oh, that was a good guy. Yeah, whatever. Sure. Yeah, whatever. He'll say whatever. You know what I mean? Obviously, nobody can take credit for anybody's development except for your own person. Nobody, I'm not out there making throws. I'm not out there living the stress that he's had to live. You know, obviously it is, you know, we also cannot sit here and say poor Mason, you know, an extremely good-looking quarterback as a backup, you know, freshly clean uniform in Pittsburgh.
Don Draper. Bachelor.
Yeah, okay. How bad was it, Mason? Tell us. You know what I mean? Tell us. You want to write a letter to kids in Gaza right now and tell them how difficult it was for you to be in Pittsburgh as a backup? But, you know, thankfully he got an opportunity. A lot of people don't even get that opportunity. So when he took the chance, he did amazing. Even the last game, he played incredible. And so, unfortunately for him now, he's got to go into, you know, a little bit of free agency, which is going to be a little bit stressful for him. But I think you never know. That's what you always say in football. That is a very Ramon Foster football nugget. You never know. You never know.
But that from so you was there in his first start, if I'm not mistaken. You was out there when Earl Thomas got him.
Yeah, that was actually a 74 protection. You know.
Oh my gosh.
That is a 74 protection. I always tell you know it's funny, like that protection is hilarious. You know, you got four rooms that have to get this protection right. You got the quarterbacks that got to get it right. You got the running backs that got to get it right. You got the line that got to get it right. And you got the tight ends that got to get it right. And if you got a 80% chance of getting it right, but you multiply that times four, man, it's a less than a 50% chance that you're going to be able to get that protection right.
It had a lot of options that didn't need to be there, but when they worked, they were perfect. And when there was leakage, it was bad.
Right, and then in this case, Earl Thomas is the only person that cannot blitz on a 74 protection. The only person that can't blitz. Everybody else can, the Mike, the Will, the Sam, everybody can blitz except for him. And he blitzed on that play because I think he was, maybe because, I don't know, he was fine or whatever, but you and I were right there. We saw the lights out. You know?
Yeah, we did. Remember, his hands, his body and everything. I never remember. Hell, I'm looking at you like you're supposed to be the army medic, like help him, man. And I'm standing over him yelling to Norwig, hey, no, you need to get out here right now.
I wanted to go mouth to mouth right away.
No, well, that's for other reasons. Nah.
How funny would it have been if he wakes up and I was like, hey, Mason, you're alive? Because I've been mouth to mouth. Well, you got a concussion. I was breathing the whole time. I was like, I know, hey, you know.
Bro, grow up, man.
There's nothing you can do. You know, he's knocked out, cold wig, you know, put some salts on him, you know, sniff him up, you know, go back to life and then, you know, go ahead.
But what's fascinating about that, though, is, man, we're an hour and a half in, but you owe me like 23 minutes. Anyway.
Oh, yeah, for sure. I don't want to go back in with my kids. Are you kidding me?
I can't wait to tell Maddie.
Yeah, we're going to go do homework right now, the ABCs. No, bro. It's a six-hour podcast. We're going live all day.
We'll do it live. Okay.
Yeah. Let me put some cracking beers right now.
All right. So, but what was different, though, now from that moment? Like, God, dude, what is wrong with you, man? I thought we said we were growing up. Are we not going to grow up or what?
I'm 35. It's 35 old. I guess it's old.
We're never growing up. Screw that. We're not growing up, man. But Mason seems more settled now. Like he's got a sense of calm about his play. Like, and not that I don't want you to parse one against the other here, but like watching Kenny being a young quarterback, quick to run out of the pocket. I want you to explain why that's bad for O-line, but also why Mason staying in the pocket allows for the offense to develop the same way Ben did with us, unless it was totally necessary.
Yeah, so I'll ask you a disclaimer first. I don't know the quarterback for the Pittsburgh Steelers. I don't watch football. When Mason is playing, I do watch.
Liar.
I do watch. Well, no, I don't. I don't watch football at all. My son watches the Dolphins all day. You know, he's obsessed with Tyreek Hill the whole time. You know what I mean? This and that and that. But I don't watch
football. But just speak on the quarterback leaving the pocket real quick, then, if you hadn't
Right. So based on that, if a quarterback, I experienced that with Lamar. You know, Ben was a statue. Ben thought, why even go through the, you know, 8 steps to going to 6? He just got the ball at 6, planted both his feet, and then he threw the ball. And the pocket, when he stays at 6 feet for a tackle, is a lot easier because you can protect inside out. So when you protect inside out, the tackle feels a lot more comfortable because if he does the loop, then you just push him by and there's no issue. But when you push him by and you're like, oh, my God, awesome. And then you get to 10 yards and the quarterback is there because he's getting skittish and he's staying back, then you start giving up a lot of sacks.
Yep.
And when you start giving up a lot of sacks as a tackle, you start doubting where the quarterback is going to be in the pocket. And that creates a lot of angst for the guard, for the tackle, for twists. Because if you, let's say that you step to 10 yards and you start feeling the pressure on the left and you start riding, then it becomes a habit. For a left tackle, the easiest thing is to stay at 6 yard. And if you got a badass dude on the left, you go towards the left and you play with that guy. Because we all know what happens on the right side. The right side's got, it's a right formation, you know, and the right formation has a tight end. So that right defensive end is chilling.
Listen to you going at Gill right now again. This is something you always just mess with Gill about.
Mega chilling. Oh, left tackles and right tackles are the same. Most formations are right formations. You know, I had a tight end on my side 4 times, you know, in my career. So tight ends usually line up on the right side. The quarterback has to know that the best rusher is always going to be on the left. And that guy is waiting for that strip sack fumble.
Yeah.
So when you get that strip sack fumble, it demoralizes the tackle. And now the tackle is saying, I want to avoid a strip sack fumble, so I'm going to overset. And I'm going to try to get him to go even wider or just not – because think about this. Why am I telling you this? You're an offensive lineman. You and I are running
back. They need to know.
If you and I are running forward, right,
yeah,
with an elastic band, we cannot beat any of the defensive ends. We're the slowest players on the field. The only chance that we have is if we lure him into going through us.
Yes.
And then we suffer a slow death, which we don't mind because we're selfless. And then the quarterback has enough time to throw the ball. But the ball sometimes is thrown with the guy inches away from the quarterback. That's the National Football League. And when the quarterback sits in the pocket and he takes hits and he avoids sacks, it makes the entire offensive line very trained, almost like chickens. You know that the pocket is going to be from 4 yards to 6-7 yards. The guards in the center have to be very stout. They cannot give ground, but the tackles have the hardest jobs. And the tackles, especially the left tackle has the hardest job. The left tackle has the hardest job. He's going against the greatest athletes. 1,000%.
It's not even true.
If I got to do a 74 protection, I got to lock up a 3 technique. I'm lighting up a cigarette in the middle of the
field. Do you not see the monsters coming to the inside, Al? I'm not your enemy here, okay? I'm not your enemy here, Al.
Listen, you know, we can't have this debate between you and I. It's going to divide us. You know what I mean? The point is that where the quarterback is on the pocket and how long the quarterback is able to keep that pocket and make the throw helps the protection tremendously. It is incredible. When you have quarterbacks that they want to run away, then the pocket becomes nothingness. Coaches say that you have to block for 6 seconds, which is impossible. The tackles lose their confidence, and it's a Tom Brady played with an offensive line there with the 7 dwarfs. It didn't matter. You know what I mean? It doesn't matter because they were so well trained where Tom Brady was going to be sitting like a statue at 6 to 7 yards, allowing the defensive ends to not be able to cut the corner and then being able to, you know, make the throws. So I think that, you know, I'm not an offensive coordinator. I don't want to speculate. If if anybody who's coach would listen to me right now and say, why is this guy talking and playing? He doesn't understand how difficult it is to find talent. You got to cater to the talent, whatever it is, whatever it might be. But from my experience, if you want to throw the ball because you want to do two-minute drills, if you want to be able to make a passing game on six-man and five-man protections consistently without having to depend on seven-man protections, it's much, much, much better if the quarterback stays on the pocket and makes the throw, you know.
And that's not to say that having a athletic quarterback, a mobile quarterback, isn't a weapon. That's the 11th man for the offense. You can have a weapon.
Right. I noticed that with Lamar. You know, Lamar is – insane athlete. I don't think, you know, if I was a GM, I would ever pick anybody other than Lamar. Lamar is ridiculous. Personally, athletically, he's amazing. But mobile quarterbacks don't want to feel trapped. Mobile quarterbacks don't want to have the feeling of being trapped because it gives them angst. And they always know that they can make a play with their legs. So they always want to keep a distance away from pressure. You know, the unfortunate part is that those defensive ends are faster than you, bro. You know, they're going to get you.
I gotta get you. Yeah. S-Fast, now you answered both of those questions flawlessly right there. I've asked you all these questions, and of course, I'll bring up a lot of this to Mason tomorrow. Mason's coming on tomorrow, by the way, at 2:30 Central, 3:30 Eastern, just for the folks who are in here, too. That'll be a hot conversation. We'll end it by this, man. I've always talked highly of him, and I know you have, too. Your summary on Coach Tomlin, honestly, it seems like most that talk about him somewhat say the same things and how he's either shaped your mindset, the message that he gives you. He has this captivating way of making you want to run through a wall for him. And I know you say you don't watch football, but of course, with me doing this, a lot of people, of course, are talking about, you know, firing Coach Tomlin, get rid of him. We need a change in Pittsburgh. What type of coach is he? What kind of person is he? What did he mean to you as a player?
Coach Tomlin, I think, has a philosophy of football, which I've found throughout. I mean, when Coach Tomlin, we debated about Coach Tomlin's philosophies at every porch talk. Every single time that Coach Tomlin would make a speech and would say something, we would debate it every single day. We would analyze everything. And a lot of times, I remember Marquise Pouncey would be always on Coach Tomlin's side for the most part. And I would always, you know, because of my role of being a devil's advocate, I would always try to see the other side.
DA. You know, I carry that to this day.
Yeah.
I'm a play DA, devil's advocate, just because it's good for conversation and balance of understanding. Yes, yeah. Go ahead.
So I remember he would, you know, we always had this debate as to whether the NFL is about the coaches or the players. That was one of the arguments that we had constantly and all the time.
Oh.
And it was funny that Coach Tomlin would always say it's the players and would always be the players, you know? And so as I've grown up, as I've been able to see different organizations, I ratified that vision that it is the players. It is the players. The players have to believe that they're the ones that win in the game, you know? But the people that have the control to do that are the coaches. The coaches have the power of the psyche because they're the people that they listen to the most. They're the podcast. They're their Jordan Peterson. They are their, you know, Joe Rogan's. You know, you sit there and you listen to the same coach over and over and over and over again. And so the messages that Coach Tomlin had were incredibly helpful to anybody who's on a journey to find themselves. And I think that's the part that I don't think people understand, or I don't think I even understood, that every year a football team is completely different. There's so many young people on a football team. And when there's so many people on a football team that are new, that are from college, you got to bring them into the same culture, into the same wavelength, into the same expectations. And I always thought that La Trobe was a place where he shined like anybody else that I've ever seen. And he would always get the best out of you. He would never enter... He never let issues linger in your head. He never created drama and divisions. He always tried to control the team. He had a very good pulse on the team. He was really good with young people. he tried to explain to those who listen about all the injustices that happen on the football team, which everybody that plays football, me, you, it doesn't matter. You feel like there are injustices happening to you, especially around contract times, especially around difficult times. And his mastery of the psyche of the human mind, his mastery of where do people come from, his understanding, is second to none. I don't think I've ever met anybody in my life that is as talented as Coach Tom ever in any category. You know, Nobody has a mastery of the use of word. Nobody has a mastery of being able to gauge the conversation and the tone of the conversation. And nobody that has been able to address things in a way that need to be addressed. Has he made mistakes in his life? Yes, for sure. But he's not the person that's going to say that he's perfect either. So I don't think there's anybody more talented than Coach Tomlin that I've ever met, you know? And so for me, I will always think of him in the highest regards. I would always think of him, all his lessons that he's ever taught me, and feel nothing but gratefulness for having been in contact with a man that I think grows from knowing the players. He stays current with the time because he's always so observant of everything that's going around in his team. And so
it's not looking over your shoulder. It's not micromanaging. No. It's guiding is what I'd say.
It's good leadership. Yeah. It's just good. It's a good, fair leadership. You know, he's very modest. He's not somebody that he's never going to say anything out of tone in the off season. You're never going to hear him say anything that is disrespectful to anybody. He knows how to keep himself, you know, very clean in terms of, like, nobody's ever gotten a tape, you know, out of Coach Tomlin saying something ignorant or whatever. He's just a very thankful person as well. Very honest to his roots of Virginia. Always has people from Virginia at his, you know, his homeboys from back in the day. And he's out there at La Trobe, you know.
His brother. His boys.
His nephew. So I think that he's an incredible human being. I have not kept up with anything that goes on with the Steelers. I'm assuming he's doing amazing. Obviously, they went to the playoffs this year. But I have also never heard, because he's such a private person, I have never heard his views on his career either. And it's not like I try not to bother, you know, Coach Tomlin, because I can go down the road of idiocracy and send stupid messages all day, you know. And I know that he's a busy man, but he will entertain it. So incredibly blessed to have met him. Never met anybody more talented than Coach Tomlin in my life. Very thankful. I hope and I wish him the best. But I don't know anything about the Pittsburgh Steelers right now in their current situation. I think it would be a huge mistake if he was not the coach. I don't know what his contract situation is.
And I don't think that was an in-house thing for Mr. Rooney or nothing like that. But, of course, you know how sports is, though, Al. You from an outsider's perspective, you've been to other places, it's all about now. Like, the cycle of winning championships sometimes depends on, as you just said, the locker room, age of guys, the changing of culture. Is more than just, hey, you suck as a coach.
Yeah, I mean, I guess I'm selfish because I'm not being coached by Coach Tomlin anymore, you know, and he is of no use to me. And that's why I always thought that America would benefit tremendously if they could feel the same as I felt during those years in the locker room, if they could hear someone like Coach Tomlin as their leader. You know what I mean? Like, I always envision that if somebody can deliver a message like he can, always based on, you know, to me, it was the staple of his coaching was, you know, the do not blame others, don't minimize your role, do not make excuses,
don't seek comfort.
You know what I mean? That I thought that was a philosophy that is incredibly effective in the world of football, but also in life in general, which is, you know, life is not supposed to be comfortable. Things are not supposed to happen your way, you know, and the more that you embed that into your thinking, then the more that you stop thinking about the misfortunes that have happened in your life. Everybody has misfortunes, you know, everybody has had things that have happened to them. The poor me, look at me, you know, throw me the ball, put a tight end next to me, call 52 protection more, please. You know, don't slide the protection away from me. We could argue all day. Oh, the quarterback is sliding away. At the end of the day, he always had a mentality that was very stoic, that was very balanced, and that it always translated into the two values of football that I think are the same values in American society, which are hard work and sacrifice. In America will take you further than anything else. There are no aristocracies. There are no Rockefellers or Vanderbilts no more. You know, if you're willing to sacrifice more than the person next to you and you're willing to do more, there is absolutely no reason why you shouldn't be successful. And so for me, that was his message, you know, and I thought it was very, very powerful coming from him. It was very powerful coming from somebody who, you know, surrounded his circumstances, Hampton, Virginia. I've been there. I remember, you know, asking him about where he was from. His family came from North Carolina. They went to Hampton. Obviously, Hampton is a very, it's a military installation that serves the military in construction works that, you know, Hampton, Virginia and Norfolk are not pristine areas. You know what I mean? A lot of poverty in there. And so Coach Tomlin, you know, always carried that philosophy, became extremely successful. And the fact that he's spreading that amongst young men on a football team is a privilege to them. But you and I are no longer in that locker room. So if we can benefit, you know, if we could all benefit from someone like him, you know what I mean? It would be incredible for me, because I think his talents are incredible. And maybe now that I look back at football, I'm just like, football is very inconsequential. If it's just football, what do you do with your life? Who cares if you're the most amazing leader in the world if all you're doing is scoring points and then, you know, get people to buy insurance, beer, trucks? You know what I mean?
Yeah.
Who cares about these things? You know, let's take those lessons to the next level somehow, you know?
What one lesson, I've said this in front of this this crowd before, man, and in general, and I've talked to other people that's been in my situation before, and I give credit to my wife and my family and stuff like that too. Definitely them first, but it was a conversation I had with you one day in the cafeteria. You made a statement. You were around me when my mom passed in camp, and I appreciate you guys surrounding me and stuff like that. And I wasn't sulking. I was reflecting or something one day, and something came up. And healing when you lose a parent or something like that is crazy. You've been around a lot of losses in life. You've seen a lot. Like you say, you had a plane crash not far from in front of you. So you've seen life go. You've seen people have to deal with that too. But it was something that stuck with me, and I've passed it on to other people too, who's lost a parent or someone very, very, very close. And you said, Mo, we were in the cafeteria. I think we were either leaving or it was Breakfast Club one morning. He was like, Mo, man, you know, the world somewhat still goes on. You hit me with that, and you was like, when something tragic happens around you, you can choose to stick to stay in one spot. He's like, if you look around, everybody continue to move on. And you essentially said, like, I'm not telling you to move on, but you can remember, you can celebrate, but don't get stuck, essentially is what you told me.
Yeah, I mean, I have an optimistic.
I say that to say thank you for that, because at that moment, it made me embrace, honestly, looking at pictures of my mom more, thinking about her more in a better light because of that conversation. And as my brother, man, I say, I appreciate that. I don't know if I told you that directly. So I'm going to take it now and just throw you a couple flower petals your way right now.
Thanks. Send more.
Yes. No, I'm not saying no more. Absolutely not.
I mean, I remember this is a heavy conversation, but you know, it is what it is. First time, and I'm 21 years old, and the first time I saw a dead body. You know, you see a dead body in Afghanistan, and it's crazy. The first thing you do when you die is you piss yourself and you defecate right off the bat. Ooh. You know, there's nothing glorious about it. There's nothing. Yeah. There's nothing charming about it. And when you die, when somebody dies, you realize that your own mortality. And when you realize your mortality, then you realize that you cannot name 100 names from 100 years ago. That there's been billions of people that have populated Earth, and we don't remember them all. You know, because that's the cycle of life. You know, and I think life lives in eternity through your kids. You know, when you pass down your life lessons, when you influence others, when you pass down your DNA. That's how us as humans in this temporary, very short life, we're given one opportunity at life. We don't know how long it's going to be, and then it ends, and then that's it. You know, there's your own beliefs as to what happens afterwards. But in the big scheme of things, man, there's a person dying every 7 seconds. You know what I mean? You know, there's always constantly people dying and passing away, and it is part of life, and there's nothing you can do about it. So a lot of times in Afghanistan, when that happens, a lot of soldiers, you know, you almost have to make a choice. You know, you're gonna make a choice that you're gonna let it go. This is, by the way, this is Top Gun. This is what happens in Top Gun.
You think you're a 6'10" Tom Cruise too? That's what I've also taken away.
I am Tom Cruise until Mason showed up. You know, I was Tom Cruise, but it's true. You get, I mean, I thought that was a very good moment in the movie where it truly, you know, the first time you lose a soldier from your platoon under your responsibility passes away, and you're like, man, what are you going to do? And then you realize that there's other soldiers that you still got to lead on the next day, that you got kids, you know what I mean? That you have other people that depend on you. And then you have to try to do your best, because at the end of the day, you know, and this is what Dave and I always talk about, we're lizards. You know, we just have a brain that says, wake up in the morning, try to find some food, try to scavenge some water. You know what I mean? Try to get some sun, try to warm yourself. And then when you feel tired, go to sleep. And then the next day you try to do it again. And we try to do the best that we can with what we are given. And that's life. And life is not amazing, and it's not the worst. It's just what it is. There's no way to define it. Words cannot define grief, loss, whatever. It's a conscious decision to say, this thing happened. It will happen to me. I got to make the most out of it. That's what, you know, optimist, nihilist, you know, nothing matters. So make the most out of it. You know, that is sort of the plain and simple lesson. Nothing else matters. Whether your car gets trashed tomorrow, whether you lose your house, whether anything happens, you know, a hurricane, please, please don't come to the city of Miami. But a hurricane just wipes out the entire city. You know what I mean? You got to do it again. God forbid. You know, I always think about it. You know, Dave and I would always talk about this. What were two Germans having Breakfast Club in Germany in 1913 talking about? Like, oh, Hans, you know, next year, oh, we're going to have so much fun. And then you got 70 years of war and destruction upon you. You will never see peace in your lifetime.
Yeah.
You never know when, you know, the next thing is going to happen. So you make the most out of it every single day. And then that's all you can do. Just control your attitude. Apps. You do apps and then you move on, you know, and then that's it. You know, you cannot dwell on the injustice in life. You cannot dwell on the whys. You know, we're just an ant colony living on this American continent, you know, trying to do the best we can. You know what I mean?
What was Munch's apps acronym?
Attitude determines practice. Practice determines performance. Performance determines success.
Such an army dude.
I said it like a military.
But that's Munch, though. But that's him incorporating that, though, man.
Apps. Oh. I remember Pouncey hated apps. He couldn't stand apps.
Because all he wanted to do was play football. Yeah.
But it's true. I mean, it is true. It's easier said than done, but your attitude towards anything in life is what determines everything and absolutely, you know. And, you know, sometimes I'll admit, I have a horrible attitude today. You know, today, you know, it's going to be a day, you know, and it is what it is. But if you want to make the most out of something, you got to start with not making excuses and having a good attitude. That's what we learned with the Pittsburgh Steelers. That's one of the lessons that we learn in life have shaped us into whoever we are today, for sure.
That's so true, man. Dog, you coming back on at some point, correct? We'll just bullcrap around the next.
I don't know what I'm doing right now, man. For me, for all I know, I'm FaceTiming you right now.
No, because if you really FaceTiming me, you be cussing like a sailor. Is what you be doing.
Yeah, sure, but what I'm saying is, I understand these endeavors. I understand that the media has been something that you're passionate about, that you're trying to give back to the people, and you have an amazing voice, a great personality. You brighten people's days. You are Ramon Foster. You did this when you were a player. People are drawn to you. This is not something. Now, I don't know if you're talking smack
about players.
I don't know if that's the number one sin of the media in football.
You know what happens? I watch the tape. And if I understand what the tape said, then I talk about if it was good, if it's bad. But hear me out.
Rabel was giving you the script.
No longer here. He's no longer here.
Was giving you the script? Giving you the script?
If there was a bad, if there's an egregious bad play, or the fact that you will not or cannot move the line of scrimmage, Al, that is something that you have to tell. That's noticeable. You know when it looks bad. The same way that we just spoke about how it could be with Mason or a quarterback rolling out of the pocket too quick.
Negativity sells.
See, this is what you do. No, we don't practice negativity. We practice truth here. Ask this base. We practice truth here. And this is just you, Al, no taking over and trying to play devil's advocate. This is your DA moment right here. You miss me. Just say that.
There's no truth in life. Nothing
is truth.
That. We could be in the Matrix.
Just say
right
you
now.
Miss me. Just say you miss me, okay, Al?
I miss you. But I'm just giving you the heads up, you know, to the media. The heads up. Know what it's like. You know what I mean? Know what it's like.
That's beautiful. Hey, man, I got to go get my kid. RJ, Miles is here already, man. You'd be surprised how big the boys are, Ale. But a good time. Did you freeze up on me again? Al's got this terrible service, man. Ale. Either way, good people, if Al doesn't pop back in here, that may actually conclude our show, man. We've given you almost 2 hours, man. And I appreciate you guys for tuning in. Dolly, you can take us away. Peace.
Without the ones like you who work tirelessly to keep things running, everything would suddenly stop. Hospitals, factories, schools, and power plants, they all depend on you. No matter the weather, emergency, or time of day, you're the ones who get it done. At Grainger, we're here for you with professional-grade industrial supplies. Count on real-time product availability and fast delivery. Call, clickgrainger.com, or just stop by. Grainger, for the ones who get it done.